Blog Talk Radio.
Sonic Effects, a place where we can lean in together and share some ideas, listen to some decent music, stretch ourselves out a bit, inwardly and outwardly, externally. Yeah, it's good to have you here. Interesting commentary today, Cultured Without Notice. I think you'll like the riff, the play on the idea of the positioning of masonry in life. But as I was working on this, I drifted off in my thoughts to this whole process of living a virtuous life. My first reaction was to slap myself silly, because that's just so incredibly boring. And usually it's a topic offered by somebody that has the zeal and the fire to yell it at me, to yell about this as if it mattered or as if it made their ideas more important. You know, all the pastoring and the evangelical posturing. So I abbreviated this whole term with something remarkably unpleasant and difficult. And I don't mean that just in terms of the, you know, insouciance of youth, where the idea first came, you know. There was no excitement. It was offered up ad nausea. It was tedious. And I'm sure I wasn't the only one in the room feeling that way, because I looked around and noticed what was going on. And then to pretend that it instilled any sense of understanding, well, that would just befuddle me. And I found that the reasoning of the people that would talk like that was simply to offer up platitudes. Nothing probing, no connection. You didn't, young people or old weren't spoken to that way. You weren't spoken to with logic and reason and purpose. Here was the fact, adjust, adapt, or what's wrong with you? Anyway, fast forward to a lifetime of traction. And I have to admit, no regrets. Yeah, some regrets. A few regrets. You know, what you would do different with a bit of experience. But I began to re-examine this whole question, you know, the fundamentals. I don't mean to shock my elders. There's not many of them left in shock. But the question is always left hanging out there. What are we doing here? This whole process of living a virtuous life. Well, you know, right from the get-go, I don't presume that virtue was oozing out of every pore of every man that became Freemason. No. I think that's a different kind of discussion. I think what has enabled Masonry to prevail has been the froth. It hasn't been like the wave of an ocean coming up to the shore uniformly. There's always a crest and foam and nonsense and noise and collision, and it varies. Sometimes it's overpowering and dangerous, and other times it's gentle, and sometimes it gives the illusion that it's almost still. It never really is, but it gives that illusion. And you know, you take that piece of paper and hold it up in front of your eye and look at the horizon, you'll see the curve on the water. My goodness, you mean this whole globe is round? But it gives that effect of being flat. Masonry, these ideas that come to us, not simply or not just Masonry, but ideas that come to us are often uneven. They're a bit like that. We notice or we are oblivious to them, but they're rarely put in any kind of binary framework. Some ideas come at different times in different states. And it's an interesting and pleasant mindset to think of it as a sea state. Or the clouds in the sky. It is in that sense a very natural process. Today we'll get into more about virtue and I hope not to be off-putting, but if you nod off and have a little nap, I'm okay with that. But these ideas that I'm sorry, nobody told you. No, apologize. Virtues. We're talking about virtues of mind and character. The whole point, why even attempt to live a virtuous life? Well, get over that. You know, really, I'm being serious here. There's characteristics of mind and character that go back to classical philosophy and Christian theology. No, I love Christian theology. It's like they distilled the ideas of what had gone on beforehand. I love that. If everything about it was original, it wouldn't have had much meaning. We needed context and connectivity, and it produced that. Wonderful. If you know the context, it's, I think, much more interesting. Somebody born today doesn't know the context until they're taught. And shouting telling me that over the first, 15 years of my life, or maybe 18 years, when I discovered the work of Leonard Cohen, the creator was somebody that was going to punish disobedience and willfulness, free thought, error. Do it one way, or you're somehow you're wrong, and then you need the church to help you along. That never worked, and you know, the problem that we've had with it, of course, like the difficulty we're having with Masonry these days around it, when we look at it that way, is education and communication. Oh, we're better educated today. Oh, don't get into whether we're doing anything better or worse. Of course, life is better tomorrow than it will be today. Of course, look at the accomplishments that we have. Well, let's not get into that. That's too sophomoric even for here. the ideas that we're talking about in Mason, this whole process of virtue, come to us from some pretty, I think, legitimate sources. And one that I can still, it was burned into my mind reading through Plato's Republic. Still, the surprise. I don't remember and memorize the whole passages, but I do remember the surprise. That's where that idea came from. So it's essentially telling us that we embrace, it isn't something we're born with, but becoming a person of good character takes practice. And it's like living the short answers, like living the virtues of Stoicism, particularly Stoicism, and the virtues of prudence, practical wisdom. This resonates around the cardinal virtues: prudence, justice, fortitude, temperance, and they form a virtue theory of ethics. So you look at, if you want some interesting references, theological virtues are associated with Christian theology and philosophy with salvation resulting from the grace of the Creator. But virtues are traits or qualities which dispose one to conduct oneself in a morally good manner. Now, I'm zipping this off of something from Wikipedia, I believe. You can go and look at Plato's Republic, the fourth book, and also Protagoras, see that, around 330. And they were also recognized by Stoics. Cicero expanded on them. The Stoics engaged, and Ambrose, Augustine of Hippo, and Thomas Aquinas adapted them to expand on theological understanding. Prudence, the ability to discern the appropriate course of action to be taken in a given situation at the appropriate time. Well, if somebody had explained it to me like that, I think it would have made a difference. Justice, the same meaning as righteousness. That becomes a little thin for me, that whole term these days. Fortitude, so you can think of it as courage and forbearance and strength and endurance and the ability to confront fear and uncertainty and intimidation. And this is like another way of saying, suck it up, buttercup. Bad things happen and blah, blah, blah. They're troubling. But we have no choice but to suck it up and move forward and not let it scar us, not let it contain our exuberance for life, for optimism. Even our history today is going to touch on that. And the temperance, think of it as restraint, the practice of self-control. I like to think that, you know, I've slipped into the sentimentality about the naturalness of man at one time, and today how debauched we are because we have all these indulgences around us. I might have had a pouch of tobacco once every 2 years if a trader came to my gate. Now, you know, you can go and buy a package of cigarettes all the time. Everything's available all of the time. Is the sense in terms of material? And so when we haven't been taught, we overdo it. We haven't been taught caution. We haven't had that person talking to us about how one needs to be sensible and conduct themselves with a sense of their own health, because nobody else is going to do it. This idea of temperance, sound-mindedness, I mean, it might be the most important virtue. I have to agree with that. And when I think of temperance, I think of the abolitionists, the liquor trade. Nobody explains it in this kind of sense. Restraint, practice of self-control. Now, if I put it that way and ask you, is that purpose, if you look at the purpose of living a good life and it contains those elements, does that make sense? Does this kind of reasoning, prudence, justice, fortitude, temperance, not have a bearing on an intelligent person? So there you have it. Clearly then, Plato says, it will be wise, brave, temperate, and just. The character of a good city. Hmm? He's not just talking about, you know, building me up so that I become the source of light in the universe. He's saying, you know, if you and your mates are thinking similarly, the character of a city begins to reflect what you've been working on. It's hard to kill self-control and abstention and discretion. It's hard to kill that. It's hard to bully forbearance and strength and endurance. Although with the amount of domestic violence and the rape culture that exists in our military, it's hard to wrestle with that one. Justice. But prudence, the ability to discern the appropriate course of action, comes when we're able to communicate. Communicating isn't screaming. It isn't approaching your topic with an uncontained rage. Now, it's using your language, using your words to shape emotion, to shape the thought. And if you do that, you confront yourself. Here I am, high and mighty. I believe everything that I'm saying. So really, you're another one on the pile of people that want to control, right? Don't do it to me, but just listen to everything I say and do as I say. Then along comes this damned process of Freemasonry. Damn them, eh? It wasn't the first time this kind of notion came about in the face of the earth, but it is. We became like the Coca-Cola of philosophy, eh? Good. Oh, maybe not the Coca-Cola. Coke is like the perfect drink, but it's completely disgustingly unhealthy. But it's like the perfect breakfast, a cigarette and a coffee. Oh, I know. The 50s and 60s, there was something to it. Life was simpler because we were stupid. And now we know that if we're going to live a good life, we need to be smart about our ways. Smart about how we approach other people and how we approach this, the bigger picture kinds of things, kind of world influences. That comes back to the Greek processes that was developed in Athens, the democracy, the ballot, huh? Our say, our influence. How easy it is to be discouraged. How easy it is to slip into from stoicism to cynicism. How easy. Just incredible. When Zeno was working on developing this whole idea we later called stoicism in the 3rd century, it's a philosophy of personal ethics, and it's informed by a system of logic and its views of the natural world, according to its teachings. Natural. So much of this has been passed down, not because we are losing track of who we are, but we're paying attention. And epistemology and good record keeping allows us to trace the source of the idea. Where did it originate? So now, today, 21st century, we know a lot of things that I was taught. No, nothing particularly remarkable about the dullards that stood up and were paid to teach and got through the day as quickly as they can. Nothing about that. Not that it was a waste, but we can trace where the source is. So the things that we were inventing in our culture had been invented and were known about thousands of years earlier, many of them. Yeah. So we were borrowing and reconfiguring ideas. We were making them our own. I don't know anymore if it matters who was first, who was the first honest man. I don't know. And I personally don't really care. What I care about is the last, who was the most recent honest man that I've dealt with. And as we unite, we are a pushback. We are the contrapoint to the declining spirit that happens around us, the disappointment, the discouragement. People, in large measures, are beginning to give up. Yeah, all that goodwill is very fine, but it's not stopping crime. It's not stopping war. So why continue on? Well, the counterpoint to that is what we claim to be. We claim to be a window into a virtuous, virtual world. We are the challenge to the cynicism. So when I hear a brother sounding off about government or doctors or more recently around here about highly educated individuals, it's with grave disappointment. It just, instead of saying, oh my goodness, I'm going to give up, it's like, dig your heels in. And it's not so much what, it's how. That's the point. You're going to hear that in the poem of William Wordsworth, a sonnet today. Self-importance doesn't carry the point. Our connection with celebrity doesn't make us more virtuous. Our understanding does. Our understanding will. And the source of that, well, you and I were going to learn a new language, we'd learn the way children have been taught. Now we have television screens that allow us to associate sounds with images. You know, this is an apple, this is a bird, this is a tree. This is a color. We would start off with the fundamental components. And the fundamental components of these ideas are a keystroke, a press on a mouse, or wander over to your bookshelf and pull down your volume and put on some good music and read to your heart's content. But to understand it, you know, you need to be able to, you bump into somebody who's done it too, and you go back and forth. It's great. I'll leave this. So stop here. I'm getting Cicero put it beautifully. Virtue may be defined as a habit of mind in harmony with reason and the order of nature. virtue has four parts: wisdom, justice, courage, and temperance. And he discusses it. So if you're interested, it's there. If you need it, well, I won't say who doesn't need it. It's Cartesian and Molinism and Occasians. Sit back, fill up your glass with whatever tickles your fancy. This, the music today is an absolute treat. The first, this is the first tune that we have set up for you is by Stefan Grappelli, sitting in with the Michele Petrucciani, the late Michele Petrucciani. Brilliant. Oh, misty. Check this out.
Thank you.
to keep listening to this kind of music. You're going to relax. You're going to put your ideas into your own mind. Great. Masonry, the masters, how we share the experience. I think my signal was hacked. Blah, blah, blah. How we share the experience of masonry tells us a great deal about the culture of a lodge. Far beyond the reach of ritual or protocols to a place where administration doesn't go, a reflection of the inhabitants. Older cultures have the advantage. They were built before the color of public life and living was reduced to a uniform beige. As if the color blind laws of atrophy were inescapable. Today, when emotional division is manifest in our politics and religion, being otherwise is fraught, being reasonable. Being unable to compromise, we abandoned that task. We gave up prudence. Yet there is a yearning to be where Masonic culture has gained traction. There is a culture of refinement to be enjoyed. It requires dedication and division of labors. It affects all the senses. It is how we communicate who we are privately. Being materialistic, we decided long ago to change the menu to something that would appeal to more pedestrian tastes in hopes of attracting interest. It catered to a particular group at the expense of other groups. And if success is measured in volumes, it was a credit to us all. Until that day when it became listless, tasteless, and could not compete with the new menus. It was the only version known to masonry in post-colonialist areas. The magical mystery tours were over there, never here. Who knew that time would shrink the space between the molecules? Who knew the appetite for knowledge would burst out? Because the social environment we need to perfect our studies was being brought to us. Who knew we would be on the brink of witnessing the next adaptation of Freemasonry as if we are spectators to something wonderful? Is it fair to think Freemasonry is a masterclass in living? If we accept the premise, the performance we see may not be as much a reflection on Freemasonry as it is a statement about confusing hopefulness of reality. Too many times we have left the door open without watch. Strangers wandered in, not interested in the work, but idly curious. Thank you. How's that? Steve Brubeck, Paul Desmond, Jerry Mulligan as a lead-in to the poetry of William Wordsworth. Interesting. This is a writer, and he's born in 1770, so influential. You wonder. It makes me wonder. You know, people like us are listening to his poetry today, because we began to value it. It's like the writings of Shakespeare or Marlowe. They don't just exist because they were written, but because they were, had some value and they resonated. And what will history say about the things that influenced us? I tend to be concerned in North America that unless we were marketing something that we could sell, history's going to be dismissive, or we're going to be dismissive of our historic granularity. What art did we support? What science did we champion? What ideas proliferated within our lodges, and how impactful were we in the communities around us? We seem to have left it to the Morgan scandal, to the anti-Masonic movement, you know, the epitome of arrogance, where we're walking around with a swagger. It was inevitable it was going to come to a sad ending, and it did. The first third party challenge in politics in that place south of us here. This fellow, Wordsworth, was so many accolades, so many worthwhile things that said about him, but his personal history, if we're looking for, that's what influenced him. Well, he was pretty unexciting. He avoided larger societies. He liked this small, intimate circle of friends. This was around, you remember that American writer Henry Thoreau, the rich kid that used his idleness to write and reflect. He was a smart little bugger. His philosophy was rooted in the simplicity of living. And like Thoreau, Walden, he sought to actually practice it. In fact, he preferred humble surroundings and a minimum of effects. And from his childhood onward, he invariably strove for economy, frequently from necessity, but he made it a choice. His sister, Dorothy, was just 1 year younger than him, and she never married because she preferred to become the poet's lifelong companion and informal biographer. Nothing salacious, not like we would think today. He wasn't precocious. He was self-willed and often displayed such a violent temper that his mother confided she was worried more about his future than the destinies of her other children. His mom died in 1779 of a cold. He wasn't an outstanding student, but he was smarter than most in his class. He was lodged and boarded with a childless landlady, and she seems to have come in many ways to replace his lost mother and his affections. For years, he regarded her cottage as home and considered it a relief from establishments of his stern relatives. It was a stone's throw from open fields, which explains some of the inspiration here. So for a guy that was orphaned at 13, he didn't do badly. He was particularly disliked by master and servant alike. So we won't get into his dalliance to become a lawyer, but we can revel in what he was able to do for us with this poem. This is one of his sonnets. And this is "The World Is Too Much With Us." Is how this. This is the world, it falls in line with a number of sonnets that he wrote, criticize or admonish what Wordsworth saw as the decadent material cynicism of the time. Oh, William, you could be writing for today. It's a simple poem. It angrily states that human beings are too preoccupied with the material world and have lost touch with the spiritual and the nature. Proposes an impossible personal solution to his problem. He wishes that he could have been raised as a pagan so he could still see ancient gods and actions of nature and thereby gain spiritual solace. His thunderous "Great God" indicates the extremity of his wish in a Christian England. The world is too much with us. Late and soon, getting and spending, we lay waste our powers. Little we see in nature that is ours. We have given our hearts away, a sordid boon. The sea that bears her bosom to the moon, the winds that will be howling at all hours, and are upgathered now like sleeping flowers. For this, for everything, we are out of tune. It moves us not. Great God, I'd rather be a pagan, suckled in a creed outworn, so might I, standing on this pleasant lea, have glimpses that would make me less forlorn, have sight of Proteus rising from the sea, or hear old Triton blow his wreathed horn. It's a warning not to indulge too much our consuming impulses. And son of a gun if it doesn't speak sharply to us today. Thank you. Desmond carries us to the next part of our show. A little taste of history. Think of what themes are being extolled by Masonry today. It's kind of confusing because it's just the focus. Just the focus. It really leaves the questions open. Here's a reminder. This is Professor Margaret Jacob. It's not, of course, gentlemen, this is not definitive. This is opinion based on fact. So let's qualify that her opinion has some degree of validity that others of us with a less scholarly penchant don't have. The oratory, extolling religious toleration, reason, and science, as well as discipline and order. Within lodges possessing a constitutional government, in sermons, as well as in constitutions, these principles are seen as the foundation of true Masonry. Within each lodge, brothers are exhorted to build a perfectly harmonious society. The Masonic utopia can only exist in secular time among the prosperous, the meritorious, and the educated. The constitutions of 1723 specifically mandated that lodges must admit only men freeborn of mature and discreet age, no bondsmen, no women, no immoral or scandalous persons. In practice, this excluded male servants and increasingly the illiterate. Promotion within the lodge was to be grounded upon real worth and personal merit only. The title of Grand Master over all of British Freemasonry was to be given to a former master, nobly born, or a gentleman of the best fashion, or some eminent scholar, or some curious architect or other artist. Wow. If only, huh? Eventually, those excluded from the lodges were designated as strangers, from whose malicious ridicule the Freemason should remain a meticulous silence. Eventually, on the continent, these strangers became known as the profane. Such men, and initially all women, were incapable, it was argued, of embracing either the wisdom found in the Masonic mysteries or the convivial egalitarianism of the lodge. Wow. They were excluded from the official affirmation of commonly held beliefs and values, which, it was believed, could be given expression only through fraternal unity. The civil society created by the lodge was to be a carefully circumscribed space. The Masonic vision or true vision also excluded by definition the private illuminations of the saint or the mystic, for the Freemason knowledge must be achieved socially. Yet the members of this society must be carefully chosen so as to permit it to maintain its secrets. Within this homogeneous system of values, the unique insights proclaimed by the religious enthusiasm as a result of his or her special communication with God are simply irrelevant to the fraternal experience and discipline of the lodge. There is no body of 18th century literature more systematically at odds with the religiosity of the 17th century Protestant sects or with the piety of traditional Catholicism or with the new Methodism than that of Freemasonry. In the British context, this secular stance was noticeable enough. In the midst of continental Calvinism or Catholicism, Masonic religiosity could easily give offense. The first narrative history of Freemasonry in French in 1738 allied the order with the English Revolution, but it specifically condemned the enthusiastic sects of the 1650s. We're about to wrap this up. That's a day of technical setbacks for me. But thank you for prevailing. This is a remarkable institution that has taken us in. When you and I scan the horizon, when we look at what's happening in the direction of Freemasonry, it requires more than the criticism. We have as we know here today, we've talked about the references in our early teachings, living a virtuous life. Well, if a virtuous man was like you, was going to step up and do something to influence for the better the position of the lodge, strengthening his lodge and thereby strengthening Grand Lodge, what steps would he take? Well, a lot of the what, the content, is laid out for us. What's left for you and me is how to do it. How would a clever man, how would a thoughtful Mason develop the character of the lodge and through that process develop his own, knowing that that we have allowed so many strangers into our lodges in that zeal to increase numbers and replace merit with frequency. We have a corrective challenge, as well it should be. It's complicated. It's wonderfully difficult. How to do it within the parameters laid out for us constitutionally, and with all the initiatives taken, the steps and missteps by our administrations, it still rests with us to put it into a context, to rationalize what they're doing, to try and see the essence of the idea and pick that up. Now think of these ideas and missions and claims here, like giving somebody a box of crayons and some paper. It doesn't suggest what you're going to do with them. It's simply, here are the crayons. And my deceased friend, Terry, first did this. He was traveling through the Arctic and in a community on a dog sled many, many years ago, early 50s. And when he stopped, he had a supply with him. He brought crayons and paper. And as he went through the camps initially, he left with the camp leaders, the camp chief and his family. And he toured all of the different camps. And when he came back, he collected the work and he left the papers and crayons for the people to use and continue to use. And that early artwork was something that became culturally defining for Inuit. Think of this. Maybe we're not quite as old as Inuit people, but the artfulness of the gesture is still the same. We're given some paper and some materials. Now, what we put on that, what we do with them is up to us, whether it's boyishly unartistic but graphically illustrative, or whether it has the charm and character that turns a head, brings a tear to the eye. That's on us. We have work to do. I look forward to sitting in with you next week, and hopefully, you know, what happened that cuts off our signal. Thank you again for enduring and indulging, and we'll be together soon.